Welcome to Sundays with the Modern. This is our program where we invite artists, writers, curators, architects, art historians to come and give talks about works on view here at the Modern. Just so that you've got it on your calendar for next month, on December 4th, we have the director of the Dallas Contemporary, Peter Doroshenko, going to give a talk. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce John Pamara. He earned his BFA from East Texas State University and then an MFA from, he studied at the Studio Arts Program at Empire State University and then earned his MFA from East Texas State. He's Associate Professor of Art at University of Texas at Dallas, where he began teaching in 1996. He's shown extensively in solo and group shows in New York, Chicago, Houston, Miami, Los Angeles, and London. He was in a solo exhibition called Concentrations at the DMA, the group show Crossing State Lines at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, and Time Frame at the Blanton Museum of Art in Austin, with work being acquired for their permanent collections at all of the institutions. He's given lectures and appeared on panels at the Smart Museum in Chicago, the Dallas Museum of Art, the Nelson Atkins Museum in Missouri, the McKinney Avenue Contemporary in Dallas, and many universities. His work's been written about and critically in major art journals and magazines such as Flash Art, Art Forum, Art in America, Art News, and Art Papers. And he's even got a curatorial practice, which includes moving pictures at the Dallas Contemporary, Real Time, which also traveled to the Pompidou Center in Paris, and many exhibitions at the UTD Gallery, most recently Seriality, which is on view through November 26th and explores contemporary artists who investigate repeated forms. In 2005, he received the Legends Award from the Dallas Center of Contemporary Art, coinciding with a 15-year survey of his paintings and digital pictures, and he was awarded the UT Chancellor's Award of Teaching in the spring of 2007. Please join me in welcoming John Pamara.
Well, that exhausted me, hearing all that. I'm tired. I think being in the arts, you have this incredible energy, and just walking through Diebenkorn two or three times, walking through him or his work, is incredibly energetic for me as a painter. And as I was telling Leslie, I guess it was months ago, Terry called me and asked me would I like to speak at the Diebenkorn exhibition as a walk-through gallery talk. And I was like, oh, yeah, this one I really want to do because, you know, I loved Diebenkorn when I was young. When I was in college as an undergrad, there was a solid year I tried to be Diebenkorn. I tried to paint Diebenkorns. And unfortunately, when Terry told me, I thought it was going to be another retrospective and that there was going to be the Berkeley paintings because those are the ones that I sort of loved and tried to emulate, not the Ocean Parks. But I've always thought the Ocean Parks were very nice paintings and quite wonderful and really the synthesis of everything in his career, which we'll get into in a minute, that makes them, I think, so unique and so special that he caught everybody sort of off guard when he did them in an amazing way, because he'd been doing the figure. And even in 1962, I believe it was, Clement Greenberg wrote a very important essay on post-abstract expressionism, what came after. And he did write about Diebenkorn in that essay, and he was still doing the figurative work, about to get ready to move to Los Angeles when everything was going to change, like what you see in this room, which is marvelous. And in the essay, he said that Diebenkorn was one of the few, because if you know Greenberg, who was the critic that championed Jackson Pollock, you know, he wasn't inclined to like that much figurative work. He wasn't really against it. He just felt like it needed to be very contemporary and be very flat and picture plain and so forth. But he singled out Diebenkorn as one of the few artists that was able to make that synthesis of, he said he synthesized Matisse, he had de Kooning's touch and Rothko's sort of structure. And I thought, wow, what three giants to be written about. But I think for the Ocean Parks, and I'll mention this in a minute, there was so much more synthesis of every artist he came up against as a painter. And it's just amazing that he could make it his own work. But if you want to just quickly come over, I just want to talk about this little painting for a second, because I feel like I call it his Rosetta Stone in the exhibition of what allowed him or helped him get to this sort of the complete abstraction away from representation, because this clearly has both going on. It has abstraction sort of in, if you were to just see this lower half or the top half. In the middle, you see the rooftops and so forth. And this painting, I believe, was 1968, I think. Yeah. And it was, he had already been living in LA for 2 years, okay, you guys. And so you're seeing, there were other paintings, they're just not here, that he did. He did one, he got to LA in 66, and he knew it was a time for a change. That was part of the reason he wanted to go to LA, to get away from the whole crowd he had been with, the figurative school and so forth. And he had done marvelous paintings and was really getting a reputation nationally, showing, I think, at Poindexter Gallery in New York. And he had gone to New York for one summer, and he had met Franz Klein. And interestingly, I've rediscovered, he met another young artist about his age, Ray Parker, who years later, I was his assistant when I moved to New York to go to graduate school. And I rediscovered that and forgotten that Ray had talked to me about Diebenkorn and Diebenkorn's work. And I had met Greenberg, and I talked to Greenberg about Diebenkorn's work because I was a big fan, and he just, like, knocked me around. He didn't like the Ocean Parks as much and I said, why not? And he goes, the color, it's too French, you know, too sweet. I said, what do you mean French? And he goes, that's sweet color. It just wasn't his taste. But he did respect him as a painter. He wouldn't have mentioned him, in the 1962 article. But when you look at this, you see both worlds sort of in this collision. And in 67, he did a painting that's not in the show. It's not in the catalog, but it was in a previous catalog that I saw as a student. It was called Window, and it was done in 67, the year after he had gotten to L.A., and it was very much like this, but it was larger, and it had color in it, and so it's very similar to what you see in the first room when we go in there, and I was just like, wow, you know, this guy, here he is, he goes to L.A., and what's going on in L.A.? Well, he sees the Matisse show. You know, there was a big Matisse retrospective the year before, and he had seen it. And there were some key Matisse paintings in there that would help him really begin to see this sort of flattening out structure. And I wish there was a Matisse in the show, but there's not. If I was a curator, I would love to do Matisse Diebenkorn or something. Maybe one day, about 500 years, they'll do that. You know, it'll seem more pivotal, you know, as they hopscotch through history. But Matisse was a big factor, and so was Cézanne. And you can see Cézanne and Matisse throughout his whole career and his body of work, not just the Ocean Parks. But the Ocean Parks were something else. And so let's go in there, and I'll talk more about the influences and so forth. Because this is my favorite room, by the way. Yeah. And so I was only going to talk about this room, but I've changed my mind. But we could actually spend the next 40 minutes in here. I think it's a marvelous room. And my second trip when I came back, I spent almost the whole time really in this room because there's so much going on. And the reason why, again, I'm a painter. I'm not an art historian. So I have my prejudices and my personal points of view. But as a painter, when I walked in this room, and you're seeing the early Ocean Parks, and I think he's trying to figure it out. You know, and I know what that's like in my studio when I start a new body of work, which I'm embarking on this past week, and I know there's going to be accidents and glitches in the work and things that aren't going to work out, and that's what I find so exciting in this room are the accidents and things that quite didn't work out, but Diebenkorn lets you see that. He was a good enough painter that by the time he got to the Ocean Parks, he had spent roughly half his life already as a painter. He figured out really how to paint really well. And there's a famous quote by William de Kooning who talked about, you know, a painter needs two lifetimes in order to be good. They need the first life, you know, 70 years just to learn how to push paint around and how to be in control and get what you want. And he says the second life, you can get started really with your style. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think that's why when Diebenkorn got to L.A., there were a lot of things that just fell into place for him. First of all, like I mentioned, Matisse. And he had already, you know, seen Matisse during World War II. He was stationed in Washington, D.C., and he had privy to go to the Phillips collection a lot and see a lot of the Matisses there, and he was looking at Cezanne. In fact, Cezanne, he says, is the linchpin to everything about space for him. So he really was able to negotiate. By the time he got to this point as a painter, he's beginning to negotiate space, structure, the architectural or architectonic sort of drawing abilities, color and line, all of these things fall together. So it was space, my cheat sheet here, space, light, and structure. And he accomplishes this by using line and color, and then what I mentioned a few minutes ago, the mistakes. And they're not really mistakes, but what you're seeing is things that he left behind when he would go over a painting or paint out a line and it dissolves further back into space, and then he may come back and draw back on top of it again. And for me, it's just like those little nuances, and those are the things that Diebenkorn knew that made these rich, and it created the atmosphere that you see. And I think they're just marvelous for that. And for him to synthesize not only all of those sort of formal qualities in his work, he's also, you know, synthesizing all the artists that he had studied intensely over the last 25, 30 years of his life. And again, I'll just Matisse and Cezanne, but he had also looked heavily at William de Kooning, Mark Rothko, Clifford Still, who had been teaching with him out in California early on. And he had a high respect for Clifford Still. He also synthesized Gorky and Gorky's line, Gorky and Moreau, the line work that he saw in their work early on. So all of these artists, and even Hopper, Edward Hopper, was a big influence, more on the figurative end, but that flattened out sort of space. So, I mean, there's a dozen artists, and somehow he finds a way to pull all of those artists together in his work, and it's only Diebenkorn that comes out of the black hole. And it's just, that's what makes these paintings, I think, so great. And Diebenkorn was nationally known for the figurative paintings and, you know, and relatively known for the Berkeley and Urbana periods of his work and Albuquerque. But it was when he did this body of work that he went up to the canon, I guess you would say, in the history books, at on par with any of the abstract expressionists, that you can walk into any major museum and you're going to see the de Kooning, you're going to see the Franz Klein, and you're going to see usually a Diebenkorn at this point as well. And I think that, so this period was a real crucial period. Those first 2 years in Los Angeles were real important. And if you don't believe me, buy the damn book at the bookstore. It's incredible. I was telling Leslie that I was reluctant, you know, to talk too much because I wasn't that interested in the Ocean Parks at this stage of my career as a painter, because I was really into them when I was in college in the late 70s. I love this work. And I had to think back why my generation of painters liked this work so much when we were in college. And it was because if you were in college then, number one, painting was considered sort of passé and dying in 76, 77. And my teachers would say, why are you even painting? You need to do conceptual installations and write your art. And I didn't want to do that. And I wanted to still be old-fashioned, I thought, and push paint around. But Diebenkorn was one of the few artists that you could see if you picked up in 76 to 78 an Art Forum magazine. There weren't many painters, but you could always guarantee in a year you would see a Diebenkorn or a Francis Bacon painting. And those were the two artists I wrestled with a lot in college as an undergrad. And I came out much more, you know, more on the Diebenkorn abstraction end. And by the time I went to grad school, I was a full-fledged abstract painter and trying to figure out where you could go with abstraction. And Diebenkorn was certainly one of the first that you had to deal with because he was being critically considered in the art discourse at the time. So anyway, I guess I should talk about some specific paintings. I don't want to totally bore you. But I decided to do the talk because, and in the process, I've sort of learned to love these paintings again, you know. And I've walked through here with several people already, and I've heard every range of different feelings, and some say, yeah, well, they're okay, but da-da-da, and I even came to hear his daughter speak, which was marvelous, and the first thing that came out of her mouth was, one of the first things that came out of her mouth in the lecture, which I loved, was she says, as I was growing up, we never had a living room, we always had a studio, and I automatically thought of my daughter when she was in first grade, came home one day and said, Dad, how come we never have a living room? And all of your friends, Mom and your friends, all have studios as living rooms. And I never thought at my daughter, oh, my God, we're ruining her life here. But to hear Gretchen Diebenkorn say that, it made me feel relieved. I went home and called my daughter in New York and told her that, and she loved it. She loved hearing that story. And she told her boss, who started asking her, spent the whole morning of coffee asking her what it was like to grow up with artists. Her mother and me were both artists. And she said it was a wonderful dialogue. And my daughter is in book publishing, but she minored in art in college but didn't want to be poor. And I thought Gretchen talked about a lot of that sort of stuff, with about her father, who went on to make such amazing works of art. This is probably one of the earliest ocean parks. And in this room tends to be the ones that are the early end of ocean parks. And I really love them for all the accidents and so forth. But in this particular painting, I think you get a sense of illusionistic space, even though it's very, very flat. So, you know, he's bringing in the whole Abex thing that Greenberg championed and Hans Hofmann, another influence, I would say, early on. This flat picture plane, but yet with the illusion of some depth. And he also, in this time when he first got to L.A. in 68, he was offered to be on board with this the Bureau of Land or something, that they took him up in the air over the aqueducts of waterways or the Colorado River. That's in the catalog if you want to read about it. But I had already been aware of that from years earlier in this first catalog that I had seen of his work in college. But in the catalog, they have some incredible pictures where you sort of see this idea of the overlapping planes, like you're in an airplane about to land or something. And when you're way up high, everything's completely flat. And Diebenkorn was very, very influenced by that. And he did a lot of drawings on, you know, in the helicopter rides and so forth. And in the catalog, there's actually some reproductions of them, and they're just amazing, that will make sense, and we'll talk about it over there in a second, just how much some of the blue areas are reminiscent of the waterways and the canals. Have any of you seen the catalog or picked it up and looked at it? Yeah, it's fabulous, isn't it? And that waterway, that's another Rosetta Stone for him. I mean, he was synthesizing. Okay, now I'm going to fit this in with my Matisse and, you know, this in with, you know, my line work. That de Kooning always drew in paint, and so did Diebenkorn. And I think that's something that they had in common, and Diebenkorn had a great respect for de Kooning's work. And I think it's really cool that there's a de Kooning retrospective at MoMA right now, and then here, that this traveling show is here with Diebenkorn, and I'm going to New York in 4 weeks, and I'm looking forward to seeing it, because he draws into paint in a different way. But I like the way, we can talk about this painting for a minute, yeah, because I like this one even better. This one, to me, is still coming out. It still has a little bit of the remnants of the figurative work, but without the figure. It could have been like a balcony, and you could see people maybe sitting on a chair, but he got rid of the people, and it's a complete abstraction, but you can sort of, if you know that period of his work, you could see it. But by the time he gets here, it's really the architectonic or architectural structure really takes over. And then what I call the glitches and the mistakes in the paint, where he's painting things in, he's painting things out, and Diebenkorn goes through this sort of tension and tug-of-war with his work. And there's a famous quote that he talked about sparseness, that he loved to deal with sparseness and learning to just leave it. And I think in Ocean Park, that's when he really was able to do that. He said he was so good at the Berkeley stage of his career that he knew how to make an activated sort of Abex kind of painting. But here, these are a little different. There's a little more meditative and lyrical quality that comes in, and he edits, and he steps back from the painting, and he looks at it maybe all day long while he's got two other paintings going. But it's just this incredibleness of the line work, and then he comes back and maybe draws in with charcoal another fresh line and maybe leaves it. Whereas over here, you can see how he painted things out and scumbled over it with the yellow paint. And as a painter, as an artist, these are real crucial things when you're in your studio that I know from my experience. So when I walk through here, I always sort of chuckle and think, what was going on in his mind when he decided to paint through that line? You know, those are the things I wonder, what thought went through his head? What was he thinking? Why did he maybe add this other color on top of this other color? You know, and he was always trying to find the paintings. You know, he said he was trying to find the impression of these things all that came together in the work. And I just think this one is a fascinating one because you still get sort of an illusion of space with a diagonal maybe like up here, but then he negates it with a straight line coming down. So there's this push-pull sort of thing of flat and illusion at the same time that make the paintings have a tension, that makes them visually exciting, I think, for us as viewers to look at them. And one thing I do want to talk about is the monumental scale. Because when he got to L.A., he had a small studio at first, but then a very famous painter, Sam Francis, gave him his studio when he moved out, and then he had this huge, huge studio. And he knew that this body of work needed to be large. And as I walked through this show the second time, I was struck by these paintings really need space for you to step back and to look at them. Even though as a painter, I enjoy them every bit as much up close, and I'm told don't get much closer than this, but you can also enjoy them farther back. They really come into focus when you're farther away. And so I know that, yeah, he had to have a huge studio to make this work. And these works were about engulfing the viewer into this atmosphere and the light and the presence and the impressions of all that he wants to instill in you. And there's so much about the location of being in Ocean Park in that area of right near the water in Los Angeles. And I think that they carry that atmosphere with them. So let's walk over here and talk about this painting in the corner over here. Well, we'll talk about both of these paintings because I think they're both amazing and offer a lot of great insights. So this one, I went back as I was looking at it, and is so much reference to some of these Matisse paintings that were nearly abstract Matisses. The ones that Matisse did a group of paintings in Tangiers that related to his trip to Tangiers. And also, there's a famous two paintings that Matisse did that were of the Cathedral Notre Dame. And one of them is really almost a complete abstraction. And this painting and several others of the early Ocean Parks really relate to those Matisse paintings that are abstractions. And again, it's the canceling out and the repainting. Even the coloration, that blue, sort of gray-blue, Matisse used a lot. I think some of the paintings that you can see at MoMA have some of that quality, where Matisse would draw into the work onto the canvas. And in the Notre Dame painting, the second one, that's a complete abstraction, there's a lot of charcoal. And so when you realize Diebenkorn saw lots of Matisse, he saw the major retrospective in L.A. as well, that all of these things are synthesized into this work. And in this particular painting, I didn't make sense. I was always intrigued. Yeah, come on, let's come down here. You know, the first trip when I came here and I walked through the galleries, I came and looked at this and I thought, what in the world is he doing, you know, with this structure? And I walked away and I got in that room and I turned around and looked at it and I said, I got to go back and look at this again. And I came back in here. And again, this is just as a painter's to painter dialogue. And it could be sculptors. Some of you I know are studying sculpture. It's very sculptural in some ways. But it was this blue line. I was like, wow, that is so dominating. You know, what in the world did he do that for? But then that's the reason why I like this painting so much, because the quirkiness and the zigzag of it. And again, Diebenkorn doesn't know what Ocean Park really is. He's trying to find it. And all of these paintings are a synthesis of it and giving us a clue you know, of his process, but he's not even sure what it is yet. And I know what that feeling is as an artist when you're just sort of klutzing through something and then an accident happens and the work opens back up again. And this room is full of those accidents where the work opens back up again. And the blue line, if you see the catalog, it's amazing the reference to the aqueducts of the Colorado River and the waterways and the, you know, that they were building, that the Bureau of Interior had brought, I think, 30 or 40 artists in to make drawings and to get aerial views of these waterways. And Diebenkorn probably took more advantage of it than anybody. And it's remarkable. This blue line is in almost even in the photographs. It's amazing. Yes, Terry. I don't think it's intentional at all. I think, well, maybe you have to define intention. I think his history as a painter, especially the Berkeley paintings, he said it got too easy for him to be so, he knew how to make an activated surface. But here he's confining himself into this architectural structure, which he's getting from the window panes of out of the studio and the space and relationships and a lot of other things. But I think, so there, he probably had a natural tendency to paint sort of loosely, but he's trying to control it a little more. But I think the largest part of the clumsiness or that little weird awkwardness is because he doesn't quite know what the form is going to be yet. And I think every day he came in, he probably changed it. And sometimes maybe they were minute changes, and some days he might have come in and completely redone a whole section of the painting. But I think he was just a good at calling when to leave something alone or to wait for days before he maybe would change it. I don't know if it was intended or not, but I just think mostly he hadn't figured it out because he gets better at it, and then I don't like the paintings as much. But that's me. But they're beautiful. You don't either. Okay. Oh, do you have a comment? Yeah. Make one, please. Anybody, feel free, because I'm not an art historian. I'm a painter.
No, I'm not either. So,
yeah.
And what I do is I go around to these talks like the painter.
Yeah.
And Esteban Vicente talks about this. He was over at Meadows.
Yes, he's fantastic. I met him years ago when I worked for Ray Parker. Yeah.
And in the film, he says, talks about abstraction. You know, it's this image from real life that you saw, but you really don't remember it, you know. Mm-hmm. And you can't quote it per se, but it's just, it's based on real life.
Yes.
But you couldn't really put your finger on where it
right. Was. Exactly. And that's why I said impression. And Diebenkorn said, there's a great statement, I should read it to you. It's fabulous. He goes, all my paintings start out of a mood, out of a relationship to things, out of a complete visual impression. So he's bringing memories, absolutely. I mean, it was an Ab X kind of thing. Joan Mitchell, a lot of those painters, especially the second generation and early people like Esteban Vicente, Ray Parker, all of them, and Joan Mitchell, they had those sort of impressions of things, and they seep into the work. Even William de Kooning, there's an early book in de Kooning, it was a quote from de Kooning, he said, if I keep thinking about a bottle or a leg or an arm, he said, if I think about it all day long, eventually it jumps into the painting. And that's, I think, true for that whole generation of artists. So that was a good insight about this work. So the aqueducts, the waterways are all there. The quirkiness in trying to figure out the paintings, it's just all there in the work, and I think that's what makes these particular works so exciting. This particular painting I have to talk about because I'm from Dallas. There's no such thing. I mean, Dallas-Fort Worth is all one big community to me at this point. But I sort of have watched and looked at this painting at the DMA for years and years to the point where I just walk by it. I don't even see it, which is horrible to admit. But I come here, and all of a sudden, this painting's never looked this good. And several people have told me this from Dallas. They go, did you notice the DMA Diebenkorn? It actually looks better in the Fort Worth Modern Space than it does in the DMA. And I think there's some truth to that. It's a marvelous painting, and I think, and it fits really nicely in this room. It's a little less accidental looking as these two that I previously. I tend to like the ones that are a little more clumsy. But this one, I think he just had a damn good day and he knew when to stop. But everything's just really working. And that blue and that yellow, the way they just push and pull against each other is just, I think, just marvelous. And then you get that little hint of green afterwards. It's like, you know, when you drink a glass of wine and, you know, and you taste different things at different points. When you smell it, when it first hits your lips, and when it goes down, you taste the horrible tannins, or maybe they balance out the sweetness, blah, blah, blah. It's the same thing in a good work of art. A good poem does that, but I think a good visual painting does that. And so, you know, I immediately, you know, the yellow just screams at you in a nice way. I mean, and it also makes you think of sunny California and the bright sunlight, and then that beautiful, intense blue, which is there in California. And then all of a sudden you get that green, you know. And again, what's great, and this is where Cézanne comes in, because his early work, he talked about Cézanne all the time. And so there's a whole Cézanne palette here as well. Cézanne always balanced out his work with warm and cool colors, and he's using warm and cool colors to sort of fight and wrestle with each other in a wonderful way in this great compositional structure. And by the way, if you ever had a basic design class, this is like the perfect room to bring a design class to and have a seminar, because this guy was a pro at design. He knew good design. He knew when to stop when it was finished. And just the scumbling, like over here in the green, just the way you see the brushwork, and it makes you think of land. It makes me, you know, recall memories of rolling in the grass when I shouldn't have, when I was a kid, you know, and things like that. But also golf greens. I think of structures looking out airplanes myself or when I fly on trips. And we all fly, most people have flown enough to where they've had those aerial views. And you can't help but think about them when you look at this work. And again, I think I really invite you not to get too close, but on, you know, when we finish the talk, make sure you walk around and look at some of these up close as well as far back. Peter Sheldahl, who's one of the big critics that writes for The New Yorker, I brought him to speak at UTD about 8 years ago, and I took him around to some of the museums, and it was like, what a trip to take a great critic and for them to talk to you how they look at works. And Sheldahl did this thing where he would come right up to the work and stand here and just look at it for a few minutes. You know, 2 or 3 minutes, he would just stand here and look. He was looking at all the little nuances of things that the artist did, the little brushwork, the wrist hand, or whatever. And then he did this. And he would be counting his steps till he got to a place, and then he would just stop. And it was never the same stopping place. It depended on how big the painting was, how small, how busy, or how minimal. And he did this to every work of art he walked around to. And then I asked him, what are you doing? I think Rick Bertel and I were there with him, Rick Bertel, who used to be the DMA director. And he told us this little thing that he does and how he says every painting, every work of art has this focal point where it all comes together for the viewer. And he always tries to find that space. And so I found myself doing that with this Diebenkorn show because, as I mentioned earlier, this is such a great show for seeing work way back, because they're monumental paintings. These are not small little baby paintings, except the cigar box lids, which I am going to talk about before my time is up, so please tell me when I only got 10 minutes left. See, I thought I would only have 5 minutes worth of talking, and then look what happened. But I think the monumental quality is another aspect, and Diebenkorn was well aware of that. He wanted them to be large. He wanted them to enhance the whole idea of atmosphere, space, and light, and what he was experiencing in that particular location in California. LA, being on the water, that was very different than being on the water in Berkeley or San Francisco. Very different locations. Diebenkorn always took his location with him. If you see his earliest works out of Albuquerque when he finished graduate school, he was out there, you know, doing graduate work, it was more sun-baked browns and yellows and bleached out light. Then he goes to Urbana and it begins to change. And then he goes back to San Francisco and it changes again. And that was why the titles are always locations. And he always considered himself really a landscape painter. And even though at some point there were figures, but he really is a landscape painter that learned how to synthesize everything into the ocean parks into complete abstraction, which I think are just marvelous. Let's go in the next room real quick and look at one of these others that I think are really sort of messed up and glitched. How are we doing on time? Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, come on in. We really should go look at the film. That is incredible. If you have time before you go today, I highly recommend it. I've seen it twice. Once for just historically to see what some of the different time periods are. It's always wonderful. But it's very insightful. And also to see people, how different we dress from 10 years to 10 years. It's always very funny. If you go back, I've been recently re-looking at 80s movies, and God, the clothes were horrible. And the music, oh my God. And we'll probably say that about 2011 at some point. Anyway, but back to Mr. Diebenkorn. Again, this is another one that I think, as Terry mentioned, is it purposeful? You know, the sort of, it's sort of like he's painting things in and out so much, it looks almost unfinished in a way compared to some of the later Diebenkorns. But that's one of the reasons why I love it, and the risk that he took as a painter of realizing, well, maybe this is as good as any place else to stop and go on to another painting. And again, it makes me, as I look at it, I just start asking questions. And I think when a work of art can allow you to ask questions, that's really an exciting, successful thing for an artist, works that, you know, make you ask questions. I often ask students, I give them a little questionnaire midway through a semester, especially my upper level undergrads. I say, does your works of art ask questions, or do they tell us stories or something like that? Because they're two different things. And surprisingly, most of the students that are younger, they don't think about their work making a viewer ask questions. And I said, but that's one of the best things a work of art can do. It challenges your viewer. And I think these early ocean parks really challenged not only Diebenkorn himself. I think they were a challenge to him. And that's why I think we see a lot of the painting in and out. They challenged him, but they challenged his viewers when he first showed them. And if you were here for the Gretchen Diebenkorn talk, she showed a picture of her when she was young, when she first saw them, and she's going, ah. And then she showed later when she's smiling. But she said that it was a shock, that nobody saw that coming, that he was going to drop the figurative painting. He had been written up just a couple of years prior in Time magazine. He was getting international fame and glory. And then he goes and does this and changes the whole ball game. But this brought his work, as I said, I think, to a much higher level. And he changed. He found a niche with his work that was like, that looked like nobody else, but yet had the traces of so many great artists of his own time and earlier time period, which are marvelous. You have any questions, anybody? Yes, please.
It seems like a lot of straight lines. Is there ever mentioned why they don't do a lot of curves or a lot of circles? It seems like he's using a lot of geometric things.
A lot of that is the architectural component. By the time he's in the studio in Ocean Park, like that very first little painting, he's looking out these transit windows that open, and everything is straight lines. And so a lot of it had to do with the architecture in the studio, as well as the airplane aerial views. So that's where a lot of the straight lines come from, was the architecture of the space he was even in itself. And when you leave, go to the bookstore and flip through the catalog, and you'll see some of those images. And it's quite startling that if you didn't know him, you would I wonder, too, when I first saw my first Diebenkorn, what's this about? Is he just a minimalist that wants to be lyrical? And some of that was there as well, because minimalism was part of his time. He dealt with that. And then there was that whole school of light painters and fetish finish painters out in L.A., which all of that was, it's all in here too, little bits of it. And they were, you know, a great dialogue was going on in L.A. And Diebenkorn, even though he was more reclusive, he wasn't that reclusive. He knew, you know, a lot of the artists, and he dialogued with them, so he was aware. But no, that's a very good question. That structure is what's real important with these. And the structure constantly changed every day when he went in the studio. And if you watch that film, there's a scene where it talks about one of his family members talks about a painting that was hanging up in the house. And Diebenkorn would often look at it and go, it's just not right yet. It was like 2 years later. He's still looking at it going, it's just not right yet. Finally, he got up, they said, and took it down, took it to the studio, and he changed one little area, and he goes and put it back and says, it's okay now. And believe me,
I know that feeling as an artist.
Years later, you look at something and you go, oh, God, why didn't I take that further or something? And I always warn my students, and it is a warning, be careful what you let out of your studio, because once it's out of your studio, it's not yours. And especially if a collector buys it. And I had the great opportunity, I say great because it was a wake-up call when I was younger. I saw a work of art 2 years later of mine that I never should have lent it out of my studio, and I cringed. And I think I traded them for something better to get it back. But I think every painting in here to me, I mean, but sometimes artists were so critical, and I'm sure Diebenkorn was highly critical of his work. And in that film, and that idea about that one painting, of course, 2 years later, he still wants to change it. So he's constantly viewing, reevaluating, editing. And all of that's going on in this work, and it's strictly marvelous. The collages that you see over here, they're amazing. If you get a chance, because I know we're going to run out of time in a minute, but because I want to get back to the cigar boxes. But these are great because you can see if something didn't work out, he would just cut out another piece of paper from another painting or whatever and stick it on. And so the dialogue even happens on the smaller works. So let's go back to that back room and look at the cigar box paintings to sort of wrap up this. Yeah, good. I'm doing perfect timing. I have a knack for getting on tangents. My students always tell me, but they're great tangents, but we're running out of class time. Yeah. See, because I could easily talk about this painting, but I'm not. This is a great painting. I could easily talk about this painting, but I'm not. But it's marvelous, and that turquoise just rocks. It just sucks you right in. It's a marvelous painting. And again, it's got some of those early paintings have. It's got that sort of raucous quality with color and the charcoal drawings and the painting out of the charcoal. It's all there in this painting. This is another one of my favorites. Several people have asked me which painting would I want to take home. And I know this sounds weird and quirky, but I want that little bitty gray one over there. I love that little painting. It's like the odd person out in the room. There's a collector who one of their pieces is here. I ran into them a few weeks ago. And they asked me that, which painting. And I said, that one. And I mentioned one that's a work on paper, and it happened to be theirs. And they were, like, so delighted that I wanted their painting for my house. But I have a good artist friends. We always talk about which painting would you want to take home when you go to, like, a retrospective. Hey, thanks for coming. Okay, one artist that I didn't mention earlier in Diebenkorn's synthesizing of artists, and so many great giants like de Kooning and Rothko, Clifford Still, Cezanne, Matisse, but Mondrian is also, and you can see more Mondrian in these. I see Mondrian in all of them, sort of the structural quality that these paintings have, but Mondrian too played a part in his education. And I think that's what great artists are. They really learn how to study well the masters and then pull them into their own language, their own pictorial language. And I think when you do little studies, I know myself, I do them a lot before I start a new body of work. And for me, and I'm not sure about Diebenkorn, but I can't help but think there's something a little easier in that you can work through things quicker. Because they're small. Just a few marks and you've covered the territory instead of the large ones, which might take you a week to get across the street, where here, you know, it's relatively quick to move a brush across a surface. And he can quickly find answers and solutions. They're not as precious. You're not using as much paint. There's a lot of reasons, but there's something also very exciting in small works. They're like little visual clues that you take with you to the larger, more engaged pictorial works. And so you can see little things, and I think that a little more awkwardness and freeness is going on in this work. And I think the intimacy, and it's such the opposite, because these are big, monumental, and then these are extremely intimate and quiet and personal. And I love that he had that range as an artist in his synthesizing of his environment and his impressions of the world in his locations, that he could pull it all together into this work. And so to go from the large to the small and back and forth, I think is really engaging. And since we're not going to have time to go to the very back room, I do want to invite you to go back, because later in life he starts using the card images, spades and hearts. And again, they get sort of funky and weird. And again, he's trying to figure out how to take that pictorial form and work with it. And so there's some small paintings back there that have this freeness that I think's real exciting on the surface. And then to bring it back to the large ones is a great dialogue that he has with himself and for the viewers to have as you look at them. So on that note, I'll probably end it, but I would invite any questions, if long as they're not too art historical. Actually, I know Deben Korn well. And I was telling Leslie that I'm looking back, you know, why was my generation, I was an undergrad when he was getting really renowned for this work. And so I called some of my first students up who live in New York City, and I said, you guys never talked about Deben Korn. What's up? Did y'all not like him? And they all told me, yeah, we weren't into him. You know, they had already moved on, and I moved on too. I mean, I was infatuated with Philip Guston. When I got to New York, when I was in grad school, some of the older artists that came into my studio, they hated Guston. They hated his work, and they were surprised that I loved it so much. So anyway, but back to my story, my students, or my first group of students when I first started teaching, they weren't as, you know, art had moved on to some other cutting edge things. And so they were looking at that. And so, yeah, and they came back and looked at this work. But they told me, most all of them said they were more engaged with his earlier Berkeley and periods and stuff, but they never took the time to look at these. But they all said the same thing. They all mentioned the word beautiful. Every one of them said, well, they're so damn beautiful. What can you say about them? And I think maybe it was like it was too big of a person to jump over, so they just went around him. But then they come up to, at that time, it was Terry Winters and Julian Snobel and that group and David Sally, which was a very different engagement. But I would say Terry Winters is a little closer historically to this type of work. So if you're interested in somebody that probably went from here, it would be somebody like Terry Winters, who's a marvelous painter, and Bryce Marden, who reinvented his work. Deben Korn and Bryce Marden were neck and neck. And in New York worlds, everybody, I think, had more respect for Bryce Marden at that time historically, because Deben Korn was on the West Coast, and there was always a prejudice, East Coast versus West Coast. And now that prejudice, it's still there, but it's not near the same anymore. It's really dying out, thank God. And as Robert Storr said here in these hollow halls, regionalism is dead. And I agree with him. It's at the beginning stages of being over, and it'll probably be another 100 years or so before it's wiped out. But that's a loss, but it's also a gain. And that's another lecture, so we should end it here. And thank you so much.